I'd like to welcome you to the final session of this third annual conference on Afro-American history. I think I should take this opportunity to thank Dean Waller, the members of the Department of History here at the University of Illinois, for hosting the conference this year. I'm happy that this conference, in a sense, didn't have a long and hoary history, because I seem to be the continuing link here, and if it's of too ancient vintage, it would say something about me that I don't like to admit in terms of age. I have to say it in other respects, but not at least in terms of this conference. And so I think in behalf of the History Department at Southern Illinois University, which held the first ones of these conferences, the department at Chicago State, my own college, which hosted the second, I would say we appreciate the University of Illinois doing this at this time. And we hope that this is becoming an institution among the state colleges and universities in Illinois. And we look forward to the fourth annual conference next year. I'm sure we'll be hearing much about that in the coming period. There's a something of a kinship. I haven't spoken to the two professors involved in this program about this, but I feel something of a kinship with these two gentlemen that makes it somewhat unusual, I think, that we would have been thrown together here at this time. On April the 5th of last year, unfortunately, I found myself in a strange city, Kansas City, in a strange hotel room, all alone, when the heart-rending news to me at that time came that Dr. Martin Luther King had been assassinated. I think this was one of the most awful experiences I've had. There was nobody there that I knew. I had never been to Kansas City before in my life. And to be caught in a hotel room to get news like this was something awful. It's kind of hard to even vocalize the feeling that you have. The hotel room was certainly too small at that moment for me. And actually, I went out really in search of something black. And but it so happened that the first person that I saw that I knew happened to have been Dr. Robert L. Zangrando. So I had to settle for a man with a black heart at that moment to share my my sincere grief. And so I felt, I really now, I think, feel a kind of kinship with Bob that was born of this agonizing night we went through in Kansas City. And then the first black face that I saw that I knew, we hadn't met, but I knew him by reputation, I knew him through his work, was Professor Ulysses Lee. So in a sense, he was a part, and I think the three of us were all a part of a very 2 days of rather agonizing quest for something at the Truman Library on April the 5th and 6th. So maybe it is good that we, in this kind of kinship of sorrow, have come to this final session together of this conference to end it. The paper at this session will be given by Dr. Robert L. Zangrando, who is the Assistant Executive Secretary of American Historical Association. He has held this position since 1965. In addition, he is Director of the American Historical Association's Service Center for Teachers of History. Dr. Granzandos was educated at Rutgers University, at Union College, the University of Pennsylvania, where he took 2 degrees. He has taught at Rutgers College, and he has worked in several other capacities before going to the American Historical Association. He is the author of a number of works, editor, including Civil Rights and the American Negro, a documentary history, and he has done considerable research and writing on the NAACP. His paper today will be concerned with the NAACP and the limits of change. The first of the comments on this paper will be given by Professor Ulysses Lee. Professor Lee, I ask as I always do, where were you really from? I expected that he, like most of us, would have been from Mississippi. But he said, it's unusual, but I am a true native of Washington, D.C. So I think Professor Lee Washington probably had the lowest percentage of vote for Wallace the other day of any place in the nation. Professor Lee was educated at Howard University, taking both the AB and the AM from that university. He received his Doctor of Philosophy at the University of Chicago. He has taught at Lincoln Universities, both in Pennsylvania and Missouri, and since 1956 has been at Morgan State College in Baltimore, Maryland. He is concerned editorially with numerous publications. I think in a very few months he will become the editor of the Journal of Negro History. He is probably the work that's probably mentioned most that Professor Lee's name appears on just now, as everybody asked him, when will the Negro Caravan appear again? And with Sterling Brown and Arthur Davis, he was one of the editors of the Negro Caravan's writings by American Negroes. Also, I think one of the other things that makes him stand out in terms of his writing is, when there's one word that's very seldom used positively concerning historical writing, and then that's the word definitive. I've heard this word used several times, though, concerning the volume, The Employment of Negro Troops, which Professor Lee wrote in the U.S. History and World War, U.S. Army in World War II, and came out in 66. The second comment on this paper will be given by a student from this university, Mr. Terry Cullors, who is a graduate of Hirsch High School in Chicago. He is majoring in political science here, a senior, and plans to continue graduate work at this university in political science, and he will give the student comment at this session. So we will now have the paper from Professor Zangrandos, Shaping the 20th Century Civil Rights Movement, the NAACP, the Limits of Change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See if I can make some adjustments here. How's that come over? All right? Okay. I think I ought to take a moment to tell you exactly what I think I'm going to do, give you some sense of direction on my part. I think what I'd like to do in the course of the paper is make some suggestions about the extent to which the NAACP shaped, fashioned, influenced, led the Negro protest movement during the course of the 20th century down to the mid and late 1950s. Now, while its importance did not necessarily decline thereafter, there certainly was a shift in emphasis, as all of us are aware. I want to make some suggestions about the reasons for that shift, and perhaps at the end speculate on some directions in which we may possibly go. I think also, before I forget it, I'd mention to each of you, because throughout the course of this two-day conference, there's been a good deal of interest expressed in the question of reading materials and pieces to which interested parties may turn. I'd simply refer each of you to what I think is a very incisive and thoughtful little piece by August Meyer in the April 1968 issue of the AHA newsletter. This may not be so readily available as some other journals, but because basically it goes only to our members or to those at conferences to which we lend our cooperation and support. And maybe some of you got one at this conference, but if you didn't, you may pester some of the people in the history department, see if you can't get a copy. I don't know if they'll thank me for that. They may be overrun with requests. I'd like to think so. Anyway, the August Meyer piece in the April 68 AHA newsletter very cogently, I think, suggests new areas for research, writing, and teaching in black history. All right. One cannot discuss the black man in 20th century America without examining the leading role of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in shaping and fashioning the movement for interracial reform. Certainly, the NAACP alone cannot take the credit for the Negro protest movement. But as a major force for change from 1909 down through the mid and late 1950s, the NAACP was singularly influential in seeking interracial justice and peculiarly responsible for setting the style and pace of black protest. At the start of this century, the plight of the American Negro was desperate. Though legally free, the Negro was subjected to a wide-ranging series of political, economic, and social deprivations. These took the form of Jim Crow regulations, sustained by law in the South and the border states, and patterns of segregation and racial injustice throughout other regions of the country. By 1883, the civil rights cases, the Supreme Court had virtually nullified the promising statutory protections of the Reconstruction era. And in 1896, the court had seemed to sanction the concept of segregation in Plessy v. Ferguson. Worse still, the Negro enjoyed no guaranteed right to life. The statistics of reported lynchings show that 123 Negroes were put to death by mob action in 1897. In 1900 and 1901, the yearly numbers also exceeded 100 deaths by lynching. And as late as 1908, the last year of Theodore Roosevelt's Square Deal, and just months before the NAACP's founding, 89 Negroes died at lynchers' hands. Against this array of disabilities and brutality, the Negro was fairly defenseless. He lacked an effective organizational structure through which to seek and achieve redress, and he lacked a regional and national public opinion sympathetic to his needs for reform and justice. It was precisely to the development of these two major factors, an organized protest and a re-education of an otherwise indifferent public, that the NAA bent its efforts. Black Americans and their friends in the white community realized the need for deliberate action to counter the pervasive racism of early 20th century. Because of hardened stereotypes, ingrained traditions, and established political alliances, such a battle was necessarily waged against extremely heavy odds. A complacent white society acquiesced in the passage and enforcement of discriminatory state legislation, comfortably yielded to the dicta of pseudoscientific assumptions about supposed qualitative racial differences, and took vicarious pleasure from imperialist ventures in the Caribbean and Middle Pacific, all to the detriment of the Negro, the new immigrant, and the brown-skinned colonial brother. The ready acceptance of racist assumptions on the part of laymen and specialists alike is illustrated in the passages of the prestigious Encyclopedia Britannica of 1910-1911, let me simply remind you here, pause, that this is still a collector's item, that particular encyclopedia. Encyclopedia Britannica in that year probably never exceeded the quality of its writing style and its attention to history and literature in its series. So the quote I'm about to give you carries even more weight, if you will, indicating the extent of racism as it was accepted then. This famous 11th edition bluntly declared that, and I'm quoting, "In certain characteristics, the Negro would appear to stand on a lower evolutionary plane than the white man, and to be more closely related to the latest anthropoids. Mentally, the Negro is inferior to the white." And then it went on to say, and I'm quoting again, "With adulthood, deterioration in mental development is no doubt very largely due to the fact that after puberty, sexual matters take the first place in the Negro's life and thoughts." End of quote. Scholarly assertions of that type provided easy justifications for treating black Americans as something quite other than full human beings and citizens. In matters of race, Booker T. Washington's accommodationist philosophy was dominant. His famous address at the Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta, fall of 1895, delighted his white supporters, Southern and Northern alike, by suggesting that the black man would find his best hope and future among white Southerners, where he would follow the path of faithful service. The Negro, in other words, must win dignity and respect by self-help and the acquisition of manual skills designed to fit him into an essential economic role in the development of the new, read white, South. However, not all Americans, black or white, rested easily with Washington's recommendations. In 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois expressed dissatisfaction through his compelling book, The Souls of Black Folk, in which he criticized Washington and argued the Negro's need for political power, civil rights, and higher educational advantages. 2 years later, Du Bois helped to launch the Niagara Movement, whose purposes included open opposition to Booker T. Washington and the creation of a more militant policy of struggle against segregation and lynching. A number of prominent white reformers also sought a new approach to racial matters. Oswald Garrison Villard, president of the New York Evening Post, wrote to Booker T. Washington in January of 1908 to say that, and I'm quoting, "The more I study the situation of the colored people, the more I am convinced that what is needed now above anything else is a strong central defense committee, regularly incorporated and able to receive gifts and bequests for the furtherance of the welfare of the colored people by buying land, employing lawyers to take cases of discrimination into court, to prosecute lynchers and offer rewards for their apprehension, to agitate for the restoration of civil rights where denied, and generally to act as a publication bureau for the getting of facts and statistics before the public." Without then realizing it, of course, Villard had outlined many of the functions and activities that eventually formed the working design of the NAACP, which he helped to found 1 year later. The Springfield, Illinois race riot of mid-August 1908 led directly to the establishment of the NAA. If that riot had been an unusual or isolated incident, the black and white reformers who organized the association might not have responded as they did. However, interracial mob violence was an all too common phenomenon. Lynchings indicated that, and surely so had the bloody race riots in 1906 in Atlanta, 1900 in New York City, 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, just to select a few of the more prominent examples. The NAACP understood the range of problems it had to confront. In March of 1911, for example, the organization's first president, Moorfield Story, a Boston patrician and former president of the American Bar Association, declared that even while Negroes became the property-holding, self-supporting community members that Booker T. Washington advocated, there nonetheless existed no guarantee of their full enjoyment of these advances. Indeed, Story declared, and I'm quoting, "The object of the National Association is to create an organization which will endeavor to smooth the path of the Negro race upward, to create a public opinion which will frown upon discrimination against their property rights, which will endeavor to see that they get in the courts the same justice that is given to their white neighbors, and that they are not discriminated against as they are now all over the country. We want to make race prejudice, if we can, as unfashionable as it is now fashionable." To be effective, then, the association would have to re-educate the American public and that public's political leaders to the necessity for and the wisdom of interracial reform. It would have to fashion a national network of attitudes and actions supportive of interracial justice. The association's founders included such well-known people of the day as W.E.B. Du Bois, Jane Addams, Ray Stannard Baker, Ida Wells Barnett, William Lloyd Garrison, John Haynes Holmes, Florence Kelly, Henry Moskowitz, Mary White Ovington, Charles Edward Russell, Lincoln Steffens, William English Walling, Villard, Lillian Wald, Stephen Wise, Alexander Walters, J. Milton Waldron, and so on. Just a mention of their names indicates the interracial mix of social workers, journalists, ministers, educators, writers, social critics, indicative of the spirit and concerns of a professional, middle-class, reformist, and sometimes quite elitist element within the American society. In that sense, the NAACP was a valid reflection of the progressive era of early 20th century. Adopting the techniques common to the progressive era, the NAA investigated incidents and patterns of discrimination, circulated its findings and recommendations through weekly press releases to white and Negro newspapers, and later through other communications media, conducted rallies and conferences focusing on specific interracial problems, lobbied for corrective action in state and federal legislatures, undertook litigation at all levels of the judicial system, but most especially before the Supreme Court of the United States. This emphasis on the legislative judicial redress, grounded on conference and publicity, designed to elicit and mobilize public support, became the association's standard approach from its earliest days to the very present. And in light of its recognized position as the major spokesman for interracial reform, the NAA steadily came, therefore, to set the pace, the style, the tone for the Negro protest movement down to the late 1950s. Only then did a new generation, impatient with legislative judicial tactics and with the delays involved, and indeed suspicious of the white community's willingness to make these tactics meaningful, turn to other action alternatives that have changed the direction of the movement for racial justice in this country. From the First World War down through the early 50s, the passage of a federal anti-lynching law remained one of the basic NAA program goals. Mob violence, actual or threatened, was a pervasive problem for black Americans, and it necessarily, therefore, became a continuing concern of the NAA. Following a series of investigations and publications, the association joined with Congressman Leonidas Dyer, St. Louis, in the spring and summer of 1918 to seek the enactment of a federal law against lynching. This was followed the following April in a publication of 30 Years of Lynching in the United States, 1889 to 1918, a study which formed the basis of a continuing report to the nation on mob violence, and a month later by a nationwide conference on lynching held at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Thereafter, the association mounted three extended campaigns on behalf of a federal law against mob violence in the period 1920 to 23, 1934 to 40, 1947 to 50. Let's examine these briefly because it gives us a better indication of the conduct and operational style of this group, and also, of course, of the reactions they met from the dominant white majority. In the first period, the NAACP's executive secretary, James Weldon Johnson, and his colleagues hoped that the Republicans would honor their pledge of federal action in the 1920 presidential platform and implement the plea in President Harding's first message to the Congress that it, quote, wipe the stain of barbaric lynching from the banners of a free and orderly representative democracy, end of quote. As it happened, the Dyer bill passed the House on January 26, 1922, but it failed in the Senate amidst a complex set of barriers that included the indifference of Senate Majority Leader Henry Cabot Lodge, a threatened Southern filibuster, and the opposition of Republican William Borah of Idaho. Indeed, the open antagonism between Lodge and Borah further confounded the association's efforts to line up GOP votes for the anti-lynching measure. In the autumn of 1933, our second period of intensive pressure for an anti-lynching bill, in the autumn of 33, the NAA staff again began to lay plans for a new assault on Congress, and Walter White, who had replaced James Weldon Johnson as executive secretary in 1930, corresponded with his predecessor. Johnson wrote, quote, "I believe, too, that it would be a good time to make another try for an anti-lynching law. You know, we came near doing it 10 years ago. I believe the chances today are better." Encouraged by the sweeping thrust of liberal spirit and legislation characterizing the Roosevelt years, the association found ready support from New Deal Democrats Robert Wagner of New York, Edward Costigan of Colorado in the Senate, and New York City's Joseph Gavigan in the House. The Gavigan bill passed the House of Representatives in the spring of 37, but early the following year, the Senate fell into an extended 6-week filibuster over the measure. 2 cloture votes failed to limit debate, and the bill was once more laid aside. Favorable House action in 1940 again proved unavailing. In the last of the 3 periods, 1947 to 1950, the NAA, with the assistance of New York Democrat Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., Republican Congressman Clifford Case of New Jersey, a now ailing Senator Wagner, Minnesota's Hubert Humphrey, and the then Republican Wayne Morse of Oregon, sought to couch the anti-lynching bill within a cohesive, comprehensive civil rights package that included, among other provisions, a fair employment practices measure, an anti-poll tax bill, and an end to racial discrimination in the armed forces. The number of reported lynchings had risen to 6 in 1946, after a pattern of sequential decline in the 3 previous years. And the nation was shocked in 46 and 47 by reports of racial terror in Minden, Louisiana, Monroe, Georgia, Batesville and Greenville, South Carolina, and Columbia, Tennessee, to again cite the more prominent examples. Encouraged by President Truman's concern over this renewal of interracial mob violence, by the recommendations of his Committee on Civil Rights, and finally by his surprise election in 1948 on a platform containing sweeping civil rights planks, the association pressed its quest for wide-ranging federal enactments. However, the anti-lynching bill, now merely part of a broader set of objectives, had lost much of its former primacy and had to share priority with other items in the civil rights package. The association's liberal and labor allies clearly were more interested in a fair employment practices provision than in either the anti-lynching bill or the poll tax measure. The Republican majority in the 80th Congress did not wish to endanger its working coalition with conservative Southern Democrats. Accordingly, Republicans proposed a more uncertain tactic of a constitutional amendment in place of a statutory enactment to void the poll tax. Moreover, Republicans proved ready to act on the anti-lynching measure only as a last alternative to FEPC, and so you had an awful lot of trading back and forth on intentions, purposes, objectives, all of which canceled each other out. When the Democrats regained control of both houses in 49, Southerners returned to their customary role as committee chairman, the threat of the filibuster remained, and the so-called wary compromise on cloture proved to be the worthless gesture that the NAA had prophesied. President Truman's executive order, 9981, July 26, 1948, laying the basis for the end of discrimination in the armed services, and the practice adopted by the Justice Department of entering amicus curiae briefs in interracial cases, proved to be the only substantive action components outside of certain favorable Supreme Court decisions that the NAA and its collaborators in the protest movement could achieve during the Truman years. To be sure, these 2 advances were of no little significance, but they hardly matched the total objectives, needs, and hopes that the association had so long entertained. While the association was engaged, with limited success, on the legislative and executive fronts, it also worked to secure favorable judicial decisions, especially Supreme Court decisions, against segregation and discrimination. And I think we ought to clarify the picture by saying a word about these. Its first major victory, of course, occurred in 1915, the case of Gwynne and Beal v. United States, in which the Supreme Court declared the Oklahoma Grandfather Clause unconstitutional. 2 years later, in Buchanan v. Worley, the Supreme Court unanimously declared unconstitutional city zoning ordinances that prevented Negroes from living on certain so-called white residential blocks. But white rejection of Negroes as neighbors forced the NAA lawyers to further litigation. And in 1948, they won an important companion case, Shelley v. Kramer, in which the court outlawed the judicial enforcement of private covenants designed to prevent Negroes from purchasing and occupying certain residential properties. In a series of cases that ran from 1927 to 1953, from Nixon v. Herndon to Terry v. Adams, the association won protection for Negroes attempting to vote in state primaries. Complementing its fight against mob violence and intimidation of Negroes, the association secured the reversal of convictions and death sentences meted out by an Arkansas court to 12 Negro farm workers in the famous Phillips County sharecroppers incident. That was in 23. And it joined with other protest groups in pressing for the right of a fair trial in the Scottsboro cases of 1932 and again 1935. But of course, most famous of all NAACP victories before the court was the decision rendered in Brown v. Board of Education, 1954. Brown v. Board of Education represented the culmination of a quarter century of NAA efforts against discrimination in education. At several points in the 1920s, the association had appealed for financial support to the American Fund for Public Service. Late in that decade, a three-man committee composed of lawyer Morris Ernst, journalist Louis Gannett, and James Weldon Johnson, and identifying themselves as the Committee on Negro Work, submitted to the parent body, the American Fund for Public Service, a 22-page memorandum outlining a broad campaign for interracial justice. The committee suggested that the American Fund release $100,000 to the NAA to initiate a series of lawsuits designed to achieve equal educational opportunities, jury service for Negroes, and unsegregated travel facilities. Although the Depression of the 30s limited the fund's ability to provide so large a grant to the NAA, the eventual association's success in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 must be traced directly to the plans laid by this three-man Committee on Negro Work in the late 1920s, and to the follow-up implementation of those plans by Nathan Margold, Charles Houston, William Hastie, Arthur Spingarn, and of course, Thurgood Marshall. From 1938 to 1950, the NAA won four Supreme Court cases which significantly advanced the concept that discrimination in education and educational facilities was unconstitutional. These four cases in which Negro students had sought admission to previously all-white graduate or professional schools, and in each of the four, the Supreme Court ordered their admission. I'm referring, of course, to Missouri in the Gaines case, the Scipio case, Sweat v. Painter, McLaren v. Oklahoma State Board of Regents. The Brown case itself was one of five separate legal actions that comprised the school segregation cases of the early 1950s. Oliver Brown sought redress against the Topeka, Kansas Board of Education, and Brown was merely the first name in alphabetical order, the first case on the Supreme Court docket for the 1953 October term. The four companion actions, you'll recall, involved questions of school discrimination in Delaware, South Carolina, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. In its brief before the court, the NAACP argued, and I'm quoting, "Candor requires recognition that the plain purpose and effect of segregated education is to perpetuate an inferior status for Negroes, which is America's sorry heritage from slavery. But the primary purpose of the 14th Amendment was to deprive the states of all power to perpetuate such a caste system." And then the brief further asserted, and again I'm quoting, "Members of the 39th Congress and those of subsequent Congresses made it clear that the framers," meaning of the 14th Amendment, "understood and intended that the 14th Amendment be self-executing, and particularly pointed out that the federal judiciary had authority to enforce its prohibitions without congressional implementation." A unanimous Supreme Court concurred. Its May 17, 1954 findings set forth the constitutional principle against segregation. An implementation decision handed down a year later ordered an end to school segregation, quote, "with all deliberate speed and with," quote, "good faith compliance at the earliest practicable date." By the mid-1950s, then, the NAACP had taken long and effective strides towards achieving its basic goals, and it had enjoyed considerable success in establishing major legal guidelines for the support of racial justice. Moreover, the association had supplied a therapeutic exposure badly needed in American race relations. For the Negro had once lacked an energetic and powerful organization that could negotiate with national leaders and move them to action. To a significant degree, the NAA exerted this type of leverage. Thanks to the association's efforts, national leaders could hardly claim and be believed that they were any longer ignorant about racial affairs or uncertain about to whom they might turn for suggested reforms. The problem, of course, was that having one's ear did not necessarily guarantee the ability to secure a politician's full cooperation. But we can hardly hold the NAACP responsible for the failure of public leaders to act upon good counsel. That failure, after all, was part of a total picture of discrimination and racism in the American society. And to that extent, leading political figures were merely a pale reflection of the total malaise of the dominant white majority. A few examples of this difficulty are in order. W.E.B. Du Bois, Oswald Garrison Villard, and several of their associates at the NAA came out openly, if somewhat hesitantly, in support of Woodrow Wilson's candidacy for the presidency in 1912. Following Wilson's inauguration, Villard sought throughout the summer and spring of 1913 to secure an interview with the president so that he might lay before him the association's full position on discriminatory practices in federal employment and its proposal for the appointment of a federal race commission that might help to improve the Negro's condition in America. On October 7, 1913, Villard finally got his meeting with Wilson, but the president declared he could not appoint such a commission for fear of antagonizing Southern senators. Moreover, he declined to appoint Negroes to offices in the South, and I'm quoting, because that would be a social blunder of the worst kind. Enraged, Villard took to the stump and addressed a number of meetings throughout the country in which he condemned the administration for its failure to put new freedom ideals into practice for black Americans. Working with the Republican Party was really not much better. During the campaign of 1920, James Weldon Johnson armed Republican strategists with extensive and telling data about the oppressive conduct of American occupation in Haiti. Clearly, in so doing, the association wished to embarrass the Wilson administration by pointing up the contradictions between the president's pronouncements for self-determination in Europe and the military seizure under his administration of a weak but friendly neighboring state. However, the effective use of this material in the 1920 campaign, aided the Republicans in their appeals to black voters. The NAA hoped that this assistance would lead to fruitful cooperation with an incoming Republican administration. But once again, it was apparent that good working relationships and surface rapport between the association representing the Negro protest movement and the national administration could not readily be transformed into remedial action on matters of domestic race relations. The Dyer anti-lynching bill, as we've seen, failed of passage. The Liberian loan proposal languished in Congress. Walter Cohen and other Southern Negroes were denied federal appointments because of their race, and the NAACP and the Negro community became increasingly disenchanted with the GOP. Recalling these difficulties, James Weldon Johnson later commented that, quote, my fervor as a Republican partisan had for some time been cooling. Until now, it was quite cold indeed, end of quote. If any Negro spokesman in the first half of this century enjoyed access to the inner circles of the power elite in Washington, it was Johnson's successor, Walter White. An energetic and flamboyant man, White directed the affairs of the association from 1930 to the early and mid-1950s. He died in 1955. When his altered interests and failing health and some inner organizational conflicts within the association forced him to limit his leadership activities within the group. Working through the good offices of Senator Wagner and Costigan, but especially relying upon liaison of Eleanor Roosevelt within the White House, Walter White on a number of occasions brought his case for federal action directly to President Franklin Roosevelt. But even personal contacts at the highest levels in this fashion could not suffice. The uncertainties of depending upon national leaders must have been clear to all in the course of a presidential press conference on May 25, 1934. When asked about his attitudes toward the Costigan-Wagner anti-lynching bill, Franklin Roosevelt replied, and I'm quoting, it's a terribly difficult subject. I've been talking about the theory of it with Costigan and Bob, meaning Wagner, and various other people for quite a long while. I don't think I'd better give you an attitude because I frankly haven't got sufficient clarity in my own mind as to whether this particular method will work and also as to the constitutionality of it. I think there may be a question. I'm absolutely for the objective, but I'm not clear in my own mind as to whether it's the right way to attain the objective. However, I told him to go ahead and try to get a vote on it in the Senate. That's the end of the quote. 5 months later, in another press conference, when asked if he would recommend passage of the Costigan-Wagner bill, the president said, and I'm quoting, "You'll have to give me about 24 hours because I will have to check up and see what I did last year on this. I have forgotten it." The reporter who asked the question pressed on, "But you endorsed it, Mr. President. You spoke several times, gave out interviews here after that Ralph lynching in California." To this, the president responded, "Just give me a chance to see what I said." The following April, Roosevelt was asked in a press interview once again, "Care to comment on the anti-lynching bill?" A simple answer, "No." During the late 1940s, Walter White and the NAA enjoyed extremely close working relationships with Harry Truman and his staff and the presidential advisors. Not only did Walter White have a hand in inducing the president to establish the famous Committee on Civil Rights in late 1946, but it was also apparent that White, Thurgood Marshall, and the NAACP enjoyed easy access to this committee and to the leading figures within the executive branch. Truman's special message to Congress on February 2, 1948, urging the passage of an extensive series of civil rights measures, officially reflected the NAACP's influence and success, while private correspondence between President Truman and Walter White, this is in the Truman Library, affirmed the latter's, Walter White's, good standing at the White House. Nonetheless, again, these high-level contacts, however essential, proved insufficient for the association's programmatic objectives. Moreover, NAACP officials, particularly Walter White, had established ongoing contacts with journalists and newspaper reporters, artists and writers, and the all-important congressional staff personnel, where much of the nitty-gritty of legislation really goes on. They had, in other words, fashioned that network of communication through which the association could dispense propaganda, receive information of major importance, exert leverage for change at crucial and appropriate moments. In similar fashion, the association deliberately went out of its way to nurture productive working relationships with diverse church, civic, labor, fraternal, service, and liberal reform groups on issues of common concern. These contacts enlarged the operational scope of the staff and ensured a broadened and effective network of protest for the association when it wished to exert influence on varied issues. Sometimes these joint efforts centered around specific questions, such as the NAACP's collaboration with the AFL in May of 1930 to defeat the nomination of Judge John J. Parker of North Carolina to the United States Supreme Court. Or sometimes the association's organization of an ad hoc national committee against mob violence. Or again, these collaborative efforts involved a deliberate search for a broad range of reforms that touched on matters of employment, public housing, medical aid, social security, welfare assistance. These concerns brought the association into harness with otherwise disparate groups, and just listing them will remind us of the involvement of the NAA in the public affairs of mid-20th century. The American Civil Liberties Union, American Jewish Committee, Society of Friends, the Federal, later National Council of Churches, League for Industrial Democracy, Young Women's Christian Association, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, National Urban League, Commission on Interracial Cooperation, now succeeded, followed by the Southern Regional Council, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations, on and on and on. What I'm driving at here, obviously, is that the NAA certainly did not work in isolation. It did develop this network of contacts. By the mid-1950s, then, the association, after nearly a half century of continued effort, had effectively brought the message of interracial injustice to the public at large and to its national political figures. It had trained itself in the arts of lobbying, public protest, and public relations. It had fashioned that network of contact and collaboration with other reform-minded groups, and it had, on a number of occasions, moved the Congress of the United States to the point just short of passing new civil rights measures. It had secured a most impressive series of judicial victories before the highest courts in the land, had mobilized Negro and white support for its efforts. It had, in other words, with care and success, followed its own initial guidelines, whose roots were to be found in the reformist patterns and sentiments of the Progressive Era, for denouncing injustice, proposing action alternatives, and seeking to implement these alternatives on a broad front. As the major Negro protest group in the nation, it had done all this in a way which set the very pattern down to mid and late 1950s for interracial protest and reform. By any standards, the accomplishment of the NAA from its beginning in 1909 to the success in Brown v. Board of Education were extraordinary. The association against tremendous odds had made racial reform a major question in contemporary America. Confronting a racist society early in the 20th century, it hammered away at the nature, extent, and injustices of discrimination until what was once a complacent and indifferent nation had to listen and had at the very least to pretend interest and concern for reform. To be sure, the association did not work in isolation in these matters. The unsettling experiences of two world wars and a protracted economic depression, challenges to America's image at home and abroad during the era marked by Cold War tensions and the collapse of colonialism in non-white areas of the world, and a growing concern for reform among white liberal groups whose interests sometimes complemented and sometimes matched those of the Negro protest movement, all these helped to facilitate the work of the NAA and accelerate its progress. Since the mid-1950s, the pace of the civil rights activities and of the Negro protest movement has quickened considerably. When we examine the past dozen years or so, our vision and perspective are often impeded by the proximity of events and the personalities involved. The historian does not operate necessarily at his best this close to the present, but there's no reason to assume that he operates simply by being an historian any less effectively than other analysts of the contemporary scene. With the hindsight of the last dozen years, we know that the promises of mid-century, the promises of Brown v. Board of Education and all it represented, have yet to be realized. Indeed, there are some among us who would feel that we have gone, if not backward, in interracial relations, perhaps somewhat laterally, along yet unfamiliar paths leading to still unknown horizons. The ground broken by the NAACP in the first half of this century did lay the bases for much of what followed. Laid them in the sense that the association raised up two generations of Americans alerted to the inequities of racism in America and willing to accede in the need for and wisdom of interracial reform. That, in large part, helps to explain the legislative victories of the Civil Rights Acts of 57, 60, 64, and 68, and the Voting Rights Act of 65. Still, it is equally true that these legislative victories would not have come about so soon had it not been for a younger generation of blacks and whites working together through tactics not customarily associated with the NAACP. The tactics of direct, nonviolent, participatory protest. Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the student demonstrators, the core freedom riders, the SNCC field workers and strategists throughout the late 50s and 60s did not invent direct, nonviolent protest. The NAA had had its occasional involvement in picketing and protest rallies. Labor unionists did employ the sit-down strike in the late 30s. CORE had instituted a freedom ride through the Upper South in the 40s. Pacifist action against nuclear testing occurred in the summer of 1946, and social critics such as A.J. Mustey were years ahead of our contemporary activists. But recent protesters and activists have turned these past scattered experiences into a pattern of protest, given it broad-based support and widespread application, and lent their bodies en masse to its implementation. They have dramatized, popularized, and perfected the exercise of nonviolent direct protest. One can argue, I believe, that they might never have done so and lived to tell the tale. And of course, here we have to qualify it, pause, and remember Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman. If the NAA had not spent the better part of a half century transforming a brutally discriminatory society into one that might perhaps with some cynicism be called rather a subtly discriminatory society. The NAA had served interracial reform in the following fashion then. It had identified issues, protested issues, clarified issues, and offered procedures for reform. It had applied pressure, but that pressure has proved insufficient. Tactics long utilized by the association were those that appealed, after all, to the values of middle-class, traditionally oriented Americans. With this emphasis on expanding and implementing constitutional rights, the NAA declared its commitment to the basic core values and time-honored procedures of American political conduct and public affairs. And in so doing, it assumed that the nation would respond in like fashion on these very grounds. At first, even though they employed different and more dramatic tactics, SCLC Corps and SNCC activists had also pronounced their faith in an American system whose rules and guidelines had been set by the dominant white majority. Certainly Martin Luther King Jr., James Farmer, John Lewis, and James Forman were as fully committed to the passage of federal legislation in the late 50s and early 60s, and so to the insinuation of a federal presence in the South, as was the NAA. But an important qualification. In a brief period of time, many of these activists and their associates have come to feel, or perhaps realize, that the American whites will not respond to the very procedural tactics and substantive values which the majority itself has so long endorsed, or said it endorsed, and so frequently utilized to pursue its own interests. The NAA had mounted one of the single most continuous protest movements in the history of this nation, and in this way, and in its own way, it continues to do so. The Negro protest movement, as once represented by the NAA, has exceeded in its duration, depth, its continuous ongoing nature, in the breadth of its goals for interracial reform, anything that this nation has yet experienced. In shaping the policies and charting the course for such a movement, the NAA has scrupulously followed the guidelines for community action formulated by the dominant white majority. Accordingly, the NAACP's credentials are impeccable, its successes extraordinary, but its objectives unfulfilled. In bringing the Negro and the white to the point of confrontation in which the white could honor that confrontation, the conduct and campaigns of the NAA have been eminently functional. In educating two generations of whites and blacks to believe that this society will accede to full interracial reform, the association may or may not have responded realistically. It may or may not have set the protest movement on a path that leads to nowhere but frustration, failure, and disillusionment. But if that unhappy prospect should prove to be the case, the blame can hardly be laid on the NAA, whose leaders and members certainly acted over the years as though they were willing to accept at face value the white man's pledge of good faith and rules of the game as he defined them. In recent days, an increasing number of black Americans have become convinced that they have been untrue to themselves and perhaps untrue to the nation in pursuing merely the goals of legislative judicial reform as identified by the NAA, or in later days in employing the tactics of nonviolent protest preached by the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The pervasive nature of racism, a sharpened awareness of the enormity of racial problems compounded as they are by ghetto living, inferior educational opportunities, discrimination in training programs and employment placement, and a recognition of the possibly irremediable defects in the white psyche have produced in a growing number of blacks a lowered threshold of patience and tolerance for misfortune and injustice. All of this, of course, is further aggravated by frightened and angry and stupid assertions from a dominant white majority that the Negro, quote, wants too much too fast, that he should, quote, go slow, or that, quote, we have had enough. And we must all be saddened, I think, by the fact that the bright hopes and the optimism of 1963-64 now seem very far beyond our grasp. 65 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois rallied concerned Negroes with his book, The Souls of Black Folk. To many, most whites of the day, and many Negro accommodationists of the Booker T. Washington School, this was a too militant and dangerous publication. True, it was a rallying cry, but at its heart lay the recognition of the desirability of cooperation among the races, so long as black and white could function from points of mutual respect and mutual strength. Much of Du Bois' philosophy expressed in that book became the basis for the work of the NAACP. And I'm quoting, While it is a great truth, he said, that the Negro must strive and strive mightily to help himself, it is equally true that unless his striving be not simply seconded, but rather aroused and encouraged by the initiative of the richer and wiser environing group, he cannot hope for great success. And then he went on to add, by every civilized and peaceful method, we must strive for the rights which the world accords to men, clinging unwaveringly to those great words which the sons of the fathers would fain forget. Quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you think about it, that was a call for cooperation, a call perhaps unanswered. Today, the black militants of mid-century have a different author, a different prophet to whom they may turn if they wish. Like W.E.B. Du Bois, Frantz Fanon was a social scientist, but his message of the early 1960s had quite a different tone. In The Wretched of the Earth, Fanon declared, and again I'm quoting, to tell the truth, the proof of success lies in a whole social structure being changed from the bottom up. The extraordinary importance of this change is that it is willed, called for, demanded. The need for this change exists in its crude state, impetuous and compelling, in the consciousness and in the lives of the men and women who are colonized. But the possibility of this change is equally experienced in the form of a terrifying future in the consciousness of another species of men and women, the colonizers. And then Fanon went on to say, you do not turn any society, however primitive it may be, upside down, if you have not decided from the very beginning, that is to say, from the actual formulation of the program, to overcome all the obstacles that you will come across in so doing. The native who decides to put the program into practice and to become its moving force is ready for violence at all times. From birth, it is clear to him that this narrow world, strewn with prohibitions, can only be called in question by absolute violence. The contrast between these two writers, each great, each distinguished, each a moving force in his own time, etches sharply the failures we have experienced against the expectations we once enjoyed. And in the face of what we are, in contrast to what, at its best, the NAA had wished us to become, this nation can have no justification for complacency, no reason for optimism, and but very little cause for hope. Thank you.